So you are all a beast with one head that chooses suddenly to be quiet. That's something. For what it's worth, Chief Wireman used to say at Camp Arcadia that you watch always at 10 minutes of the hour people went quiet when they were eating. I never noticed it. But I never forgot that he said that, and I always kept watching. I figured the only thing was is that once the food got on the table, people ate and didn't talk. This is all just a kind of a signal to people in the tape room that we're about to start. I should tell you just before we do start, I bet it just clicked on, that I have chapel tonight as well, and so I'm going to try hard to watch my time. I left my notes in my room. I just figured that out before I rang the bell, and it'll tell me how the order of service goes, so I'll have to leave here and rush over and get my notes. Yes, we will start now. This is the fourth in a series called An Autobiography of Faith. I have kept the title for this fourth part, Self's Failure, but I've added the subtitle, The Necessary Desolation, and could even add The Necessary Death, I think. If the story that we are telling throughout this week has a climax, the climax is this evening. That doesn't necessarily make the story any more exciting at this point. It means that this is the metanoia, or the turnaround. It also doesn't mean that if you've missed previous lectures that you will not be able to follow tonight, because I will set you up well enough. But I say this because one thing I want to say, even before I get to my introduction, I want to tell all of you this, that what I have to say tonight is a good thing. It is a good thing. Please hear it as a good thing. It will not always look like a good thing, and if you remember this same kind of experience happening for you, and I suspect all of you will find something like this to one degree or another, more or less intense within your lives. However wretched that time felt, it was a necessary and a blessed wretchedness. And then I turn it the other way around and I say, I suspect you know people who may be entoiled in this experience, which we will describe tonight, the failure of the self. I know that when I met such people previously, I grieved for them. I saw them to be despairing, and I found myself descending into despair with them, wishing that there was something I could do. Now I realize that for many, many of these people, in fact, the thing itself is happening. It is happening. The despair is itself a part of a salvific experiential act. And now I know that I don't have to despair with them. What I need to do is to sit beside them and wait for the moment when they finally look up and their eyes are open so that I can name proper names, so that I can touch them when they are prepared for the touch. Now I don't go into hell with them as they do. I think, I guess, that this is going to be exceedingly Lutheran, at least in terms of Luther's experience and some of these outrageously paradoxical comments that Luther made, that God damns us in order to save us. All this, I hope, will come clear as we go. But to set you up for this experience, I would like now to go back to something that I had talked about before and intentionally contradict myself. Earlier in this week, when I talked about memorization and some of the practices that we have in teaching children the faith, I said that it was necessary for us to be naming the experiences they had already had, and that it was important for us to search out what those experiences were. Some of you may remember that I said that.
Yeah.
Good, thank you. I was looking for one nod, one yes. Okay, I'm going to contradict that now, but I don't mean to take away anything from what I said. Now what I would like to say is, I also believe that memorization is an excellent help in advance of the experiences which the child may not yet have had, and that theology is an excellent preparation for those experiences. The only thing I want us to guard against is that we would ever forget the importance of this whole process of memorization or theology being a naming of experience, of things which are in the relationship between God and the people. Please understand that. I think that it is good. I in my confirmation class, some of my memory work became what I now understand to have been a cup, but an empty cup. I believe that I cannot by my own reason or strength believe upon my Lord Jesus Christ or come to him. But the Holy Ghost has called me by the gospel, enlightened me with the gifts, called and sanctified, kept me in the one true faith, as even as he calls, gathers and enlightens. You remember that. Luther's explanation to the third article of the Creed, which I learned at confirmation and never forgot. I will tell you that at confirmation it was meaningless to me. I did not understand it, experienced enough, but it was like an empty cup. And my mind seized upon it, and it got tucked back there somewhere. You see how at 42 I run it off. But it was the empty cup, and here's how I say it. It was the empty cup awaiting to be filled with my experience, so that when the experience came and went into that cup, the cup gave it shape. The theology gave it shape. That's one good thing about memorization, even in advance of the experience. A second way I like to think about it is as the delayed dialogue. Again and again, relationship is essential in this process, this motion through the drama of faith. But some experiences, like the one I'm about to talk about now, are exceedingly private, and they happen when other people may not be around, and nobody may be able to sit down and say, let me tell you what happened to you. Let me give it a name. On the other hand, I know that my experience stored up scripture texts, proof texts, and so forth, which earlier had maybe a simple-minded meaning to me, but they waited as they were lurking in the back of my mind so that when the experience came, then it was that my pastor was speaking to me 15 years later. But I had remembered. I memorized John 10. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me. And there are other sheep that are not of this fold. I must call them also, so there shall be one fold and one shepherd. I memorized that. It was a sweet little thing to memorize. I never lost it. It stayed in my mind. When the time came that I began by my soul and wordlessly, hear me, to ask the profound questions, what I remembered was there to answer. It was a delayed dialogue. And in that sense, even as a pastor then, I remember, Dad, you said that, you know, that we don't throw memory out. In that sense, then I also had the people in my congregation, the children, memorize. Okay? That's introduction. The beginning of this segment, this experience, this self-failure, I'm calling the blasphemous attitude. I want to talk about the attitude which leads up to it. It's the attitude where we ended yesterday. And if you're not here, I'll fill it in just a little bit for you. You know, several people said to me today, boy, we got to get back and hear how that story ends. Okay. I'm so glad you did that, because do you know that yesterday I ended in triumph? I was triumphant at the end. You see how my hands are up? What does that remind you of? Rocky. I was triumphant at the end yesterday. I was. And I was not Rocky. I don't have muscles like Rocky. Has muscles, good Lord, I can't eat raw eggs. But I could write. Those were my muscles. And do you know that most of the world would have thought that the story was done yesterday? They would have conceived that story to have been done, that I had written myself into society, I had written myself into a reputation, I had written myself into value and worth and completeness, and people praised me for it. That's where movies end. That's where people wipe a tear from their eye and go home. I'm so glad you said you wanted to hear the end of the story, because that is a deadly place to be. It is a blasphemous place to be. It is, I call it, the blasphemous attitude. You must not assume. I ended last night or yesterday talking about my high school experience to you. And what I'm going to talk about essentially here took place in graduate school, and I'm going to ask you in a little while to move the setting then from Milwaukee, Wisconsin to Oxford, Ohio, University, Miami University in Oxford. You must not assume that during those 6, 7, 8 years between what I told you yesterday and what I'm going to tell you today, I lived a bad life. I mean, that I lived a sad life. I didn't. I mean, I was up and down, and I hardly realized this triumphant attitude that I had had. I hardly realized. Let me say it clearly to you. I hardly realized that I had switched allegiance in my life. I was no longer completely trusting upon God. I was trusting in Walt Wanderer, who in those days everybody called Wally. You must understand, for my dad, you know, you'll notice he gives a beep before he says my name here always. He never called me Walt. But since people are calling me Walt here, he's saying Walt. He's being kind. But what goes through his head is Wally. What comes out is Walt. So I was Wally in those days. And I didn't even realize what had happened for me. All that went on for me for most of those years, this is the subtle, maybe even the hideous deception of this whole thing, took place within the context, within the structure of the church. I was like a worm in a cocoon. I was protected by the cocoon. I was shaped by the cocoon, but I was not a part of the cocoon, and I didn't know that. I was in the system of the church. I did the ritual worships of the church, and I thought myself to be trusting in God, but I wasn't. And I didn't know that. You must understand, what I'm about to tell you is hindsight. Very often, that's exactly how it comes, that we dwell within the structures, within the house, but we are not a part of the house sometimes. I was not committed to it, but simply because the house was there, I felt just fine. One other preparatory comment to those of you who are watching others struggle through the despair I'm going to describe. It will look as though that person has fallen from faith. And in the sense of trusting God, that person has. I did. But in the sense of a relationship to God, there still is a faith going. Because even if that person fell, even if that person is looking elsewhere or trusting in self, God is always there. And that, for me, these days is a comfort. God is there as creator, even calling creative things out of bad situations. Please remember that. God doesn't leave a person. I call it a blasphemous attitude because this was my creed in those days. I didn't know it was a creed, but it was. I mean, in church I would say, I believe in God, Jesus Christ, Holy Spirit. I would say that. And I thought I believed that. But I did not, for my shalom, my peace, my existence, depend upon it. This is what I would say. While I was walking to the pancake house where I worked, I was dishwasher busboy in a pancake house. I didn't like that job. There was another fellow there who used to make sexual gestures to me because he knew how much that embarrassed me. It really did. It did. My face flamed red when he did that. And he would always do it. We were in a kitchen where there was windows all around. There were all people sitting out there. And he would do it just below the counter so that none of these people quietly eating pancakes in a pancake house. There wasn't even liquor there. Would know the sexual gestures this guy was making toward me. And it fuddled me. It always fuddled me so much I would drop dishes and break things. So I hated working there, but I had to. And always when I went there, I said to myself, I did, I remember, I repeated it like the litany. I said, I am smart. Because I was smarter than that guy. I said, I am a writer. I said that very often. I said, I am an actor. I said, I am able, I am intelligent, I know German, I know Latin, I'm learning Greek, I am smart, I am smart, I am smart. I said, I am. I said, I am. That was my creed. It was to say I am and then to add adjectives afterward that would say what I was. But I found my peace in that because I constantly measured myself against that person and I saw that he was foolish and he was stupid and he was street and he would get nowhere, but I was smart. I am, I said. I believe this attitude to be not uncommon in this country. I believe this attitude to be this country's general attitude. To say, I am, I can figure things out, I can fix them, I will, now get the impossibility of this, I will lift myself up by my own bootstraps. But I believe I can, and I tell my children that they should do the same thing. That the work ethic, when it doesn't have anything else involved in it, is an I am ethic. It is an interning ethic. It is a worship of one's own self, one's ability to keep certain laws. This is my symbol, interning. The arrow turns inside. The sense that any problem that arises before us generally in this country, give us time, we will solve it. Whether it's a moral problem, we are generally good people. We are. We are. We are. Whether it's a technical problem, we are exceptionally intelligent people. We will solve those things. Just give us time. We will do it. We will. And I think this is not uncommon among adolescents and people entering into the world. I think that this has to do with the whole issue of where do I find my worth? Why I find my worth in me. Feel good about yourself. I have to feel good about myself. That's a creed which is in turning, that I must feel good about. If it feels good, here's our morality. If it feels good,
do it.
And when we even be careful about that. We say, so long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. Nevertheless, the issue is my own satis faction, my own being filled up. I am, I say, and that is the creed. I am. I create myself. I am. I keep repeating that. Perhaps some of you are hearing the echo. In Greek, I am is, well, I don't mean the echo of my repeating. I mean the echo of what it means. Ego, a, me, ego, a, me. I am. I put it in Greek because in the Septuagint, that is in the Greek Old Testament, do you know how they translate the name for God? I am. I am. The tetragrammaton, the four letters, Yahweh, means I will be what I will be. I am self-actuating, some fancy word. I am my own authority. I make myself. This is the only thing. In other words, this attitude of I am, I triumph, I can do it, I will beat up the other person, I am the writer that creates myself, is blasphemous. You must understand that in John, when Jesus said to the Pharisees, even in the midst of a sentence, I am, they wanted to throw stones at him. Because they heard in there the name of the deity. They perceived what Jesus was really doing. Jesus was using that Old Testament name and applying it to himself. And subtly saying, I am the deity. I am above time. This is a blasphemous, dangerous act. But I didn't know that. I was in the structure of the church. The church was smiling on me. I was going to be a preacher. Well, and if I was going to be a preacher, how could I be bad? I was one of the faithful. Yet I had begun to read poetry in those days, and I know what drew my heart, people. If I can fill in this attitude and make you understand it more and more. I read Matthew Arnold, Dover Beach, and I instantly memorized it. I didn't have to try, because there was a sweet self-pity in that, and I said, I understand this. Dover Beach. Matthew Arnold sets up a circumstance where he goes to a window and he looks out over Dover Beach. He looks down to the beach itself and he sees the tide going out. It goes miles out at that point. It makes a scratching, sad, forlorn sound as it draws the stones and the shale after it. And he says, once long, long ago, Sophocles looked at the sea going out like this. And Sophocles saw one thing to go out. He said, but we find a different meaning in there. He said, we see this to be faith receding from the world. And there's a sadness. There's a sadness as he says this. We hear faith going farther and farther away to the forlorn distances. And then he's got only one thing left. And this used to drive through my mind. This went through my mind with more power and blessing than the hymns that I sang in chapel. Ah, love, he said. Ah, love. Let us be true to one another. That's all he had left. The trust among people. Ah, love. Let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy nor love nor light nor certitude nor peace nor help from pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, fraught with alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by. I understood that, and I still went to chapel, and I sang the song, and I was going to be a pastor. Dangerous. I memorized a poem that meant nothing. And I used this in a sardonic, cynical way on people. I used to tell them the poem and get them to laugh and chuckle and enjoy it, and in my heart I said, you fools, it means nothing. Twas brillig in the slithy toes did gyre and gimble in the wave. All mimsy were the borogoves, and the mome rats outgrabe. You know that?
Yeah.
Beware the jabberwock, my son. The claws, the jaws that bite, the claws that catch. Beware the jujube bird, and shun the frumious bandersnatch. He took his vorpal blade in hand. Long time the maximum foe he sought. Then rested he near the tum-tum tree, and stood a while in thought. And then goes on. He says, Jabberwock comes with eyes of flame and then says, one, two, and through, his vorpal blade went snicker snack. He left it dead. And with its head, he went galumphing back. It's one word that means something. That's where that word comes from. Do you know that galumphing? There's another word coming up. He went galumphing back. Ah!
hast thou killed the Jabberwock? Come to my arms, my beamish boy. Oh, frabjous day, calloo callay. She chortled in her joy. Means nothing. And I got the grandest kick out of saying that to people, adults and children alike. See, you were smart. I told you already. You didn't even crack a smile. And they'd say, oh, and in my heart, I was thinking, means nothing. Because what meant something was me. I am. Outside of me, I wasn't sure anymore. This is a blasphemous attitude. I was reading in those times. I have to pull literature in at this point, people, because literature had become part of my life and that kind of a thinking. I'd be grateful as you work with me on this kind of thing. But I was reading Albert Camus then. This is the early part of college. And existentialism. Is this somewhat familiar to some of you? All right. And it was drawing my soul, Albert Camus. The Stranger is a very, very simple novel about a man who kills another person and goes to trial and in the end is hanged. It's all in the first person, so you don't see the hanging. But you see this person prepare for the hanging, and I thought it was marvelous. In the very, very end, the person is at peace. At peace. Because this person said, you've got to hang with me. Because the past means nothing. It is not. The past is not. The only reason it means something is because we allow societies and religions to foist upon us their spiritual fictions and make us feel guilty for things that do not exist anymore. The past isn't. And in fact, whatever the past was. Its rightness was that it was. Do you understand that? It isn't an issue that it should have been something else or something else. It is what it was. I lived my life as I have lived it. This was enormously freeing to me. The future, because it isn't yet, isn't. And the only thing that makes the future loom over me and make me scared is either the fear that I shall fail at some law or something, which is again a spiritual fiction, or else the hope that makes me want to get into the future denies the present and keeps me rushing into the future to fulfill something that isn't here yet anyway, and so why should I worry about it? The existentialist says there is only one point in time which is real, and that is now. And then the next issue is, well, what is real in this point of time right now? Well, they begin looking like empiricists. They begin seeming to believe that stones are real because they are out there. That's all. Certainly religions are not real. Laws are not real. Those are the fictions of minds that people are bound to. But that's not even real, the stone. Listen to me. What is real is my touch of that stone. That's what's real. It's the connection between me and the universe. It is my senses that makes me exist. The stone is real to my eyes. And in that meeting between the eyeball and the stone, right, then it comes to be, and I am. In the slapping, I can still feel the tingle from slapping that stone. That's the reality. It is in that touch. So, says the existentialist, what do I seek in this life? I know I am cheating the fullness of this philosophy, but I was only in college. What is real in this life is sensation. What I should seek in this life is sensation. And if I'm going to die 5 minutes hence or 5 years hence, what difference does that make? I am here now. And the very end of this novel, the murderer says, why shouldn't I read it to you? No one in the world had any right to weep for her or for me. He's talking about his mother. And I too felt ready to start life all over again. He says this on the morning of his guillotine. It was as if a great rush of anger had washed me clean, emptied me of hope, emptied me of hope. And gazing up at the dark sky spangled with its signs and stars, for the first time, I laid my heart open to the benign indifference of the universe. To feel it so like myself, indeed so brotherly, made me realize that I'd been happy and that I was happy still. For all to be accomplished, for me to be feel less lonely, all that remained to hope was that on the day of my execution, there should be a huge crowd of spectators and that they should greet me with howls of execration. That was sensation, because he could hear and feel. But if death is the next second, yet it isn't. And when it is, then I am not. So what? That was an enticing philosophy. And I still sang, blessed be the tie that binds. And I still said, I believe in, and I believe in, and I believe in. And I didn't even notice where I was shifting my loyalties. I met my existentialist. And at first, I respected him, and then I rejected him because I was better than him. His name was Tex. Well, his name really wasn't Tex.
I mean, we didn't know what his name was, okay? This is when my brother Paul and I worked with migrant workers on the PPAC in central Illinois one summer. We lived in bunk houses. It was heavy labor when the peas were running, whatever that means, when they were ripe and it was ready to go. We would get up before the sun, and we would not get to bed until after the sun was down. We worked. I think we got all of 5 hours of sleep, and we worked 18 hours a day, constantly. I remember that when I used to wake up in this bunkhouse dwelling, it's just other just men, traveling. There were not families in this particular migrant labor. I would wake up after working a full previous day, and my fingers were so stiff. You know how you can crack your knuckles sometimes like this? All I had to do is close my fingers, and they crack from working the whole day before. You had to work at it like this. And I hated the work. I hated it. I hated getting up in the dim light, and then we had to turn lights on over these enormous machines, and then to pull the vines into the machines and let them go up and get hit. The pods got hit by these flying fins, so they'd pop the peas out, and they'd run down the treadle, and we had to do that. In that bunkhouse, there was Mike Dino, came from Alabama. I could not understand a word he said, but that boy could ride a horse. He could ride a horse. He got two horses for us one day. He said, "Watch it, when you touch that horse to turn, it'll turn." I said, "Sure, that's the idea." We went riding out through the fields, and I just touched its left flank. It turned, and I went straight. Mike Dino, but see, Mike, he wrote one hand. He was beautiful. There was a guy named Cherry in that bunkhouse who was lazy. He was long and thin like a licorice stick, was Cherry. He used to sit on top of his bunk biting his toenails, drew the contempt of everybody, and boasting about Tulsa, Oklahoma. And there was Tex, and I for a while respected Tex. He was my existentialist. Tex was called Tex because when he appeared, he was in full cowboy regalia. He had on cowboy boots with great big heels, pointy toes. He had piping down the edge of his pants. I mean, he wasn't cowboy that worked on the range. He was cowboy that sang, you know, that kind of thing, although he didn't sing. He never talked. Tex didn't know it was in Tex's head. He wore the kind of cowboy things, you know, where you got pockets with little snaps on them and snaps down the front, and he had a hat. That's how he worked for 2 weeks until he got his first paycheck. So we called him Tex. He didn't tell us anything else. He just worked silently. He was short. He worked steadily, but not a lot, and he wore his cowboy stuff. He went in the fields with his cowboy boots, kept sinking in the mud. When he got his paycheck, this was Tex's habit. I found out on the first weekend. He took his paycheck into town, which at that point was Rochelle, Illinois. Cashed it. We were working for Damani. Cashed it. Took his money first to a restaurant. Bought himself the fanciest, biggest burping meal he possibly could. Went next to a clothing store, stripped himself of all the clothes that he had, threw them away, bought totally new clothes, new shoes, new underwear, everything dressed up. Went to a gas station, washed his face, found himself a woman. I don't know how to say that right. I just don't know. And then ended up by getting himself terribly drunk. Now, the stuff that he did, I didn't. That's not what I respect. What I respected about Tex as I was reading this existentialist stuff was, here was a guy who lived in the moment, I thought. He lived in the moment. He spent his entire check and then he ate with the cook maid for 2 weeks. By the way, I'm not going to look beautiful to you during this, okay? During this whole story. I think I was an utter fool, but nevertheless, this is what was. This is I am. Tex lived exactly for what was. He lived for the immediate desires, and I thought, this is something I can never do. But this is marvelous that this fellow is simply living always in the day, never working too hard, never working too soft, making his 2 weeks' pay, and into Rochelle he goes. Tex. Respected Tex. Used to watch him, stand back behind him and watch him. Wonder if he ever read Camus. Sucker never read anything. One day, we were station 16, we got the telephone call. Tex had ended up late Saturday night at station 6. He swore up and down that it was his station. Nobody could touch him, he was fire-eyed. Tex had the deepest sky blue eyes I've ever seen. You could sink into those eyes. But he wouldn't let anybody touch him, and he went up to a bunk and he said, "This is my bunk," threw up on it, and lay down on it. and went to sleep. Now, I don't know, I was one of the tallest people in that station. Strangely, many of the people that you might know on migrant workers are not big, they're small. And so I was 6'1", and I was bigger, and the timekeeper, Jack, used to take me, he used to think that I was strong, and he took me along to go get Tex. And I saw a whole new side of existentialism. It's true, that's true. This is where I rejected it, but I'll tell you how I did. I think Tex was, I'm not kidding, I think in certain respects Tex was an existentialist. But when we got there, that bleary-eyed fool, he opened up his eyes and he still had these deep blue, but all around the blue was burning red. It was just burning red. The man was sick. He was retching. And when we tried first gently to say, come on, Tex, you're going to go home, he said, this is my station, he said, this is my station. And Jack, the timekeeper, was about like this to me, so it was me who had to do it. And I went up and I grabbed hold of the guy's wrist to try to ease him up, and it was like I caught hold of a fish that thrashed. He went, ba-da-da-da! It was contemptible. It was loathsome. And I found out I was so much stronger than him. It was a shock to me. He shook and wobbled at the end of my arm like that, and I could almost just lift him up like this. Tex. That was Tex. Right here. That was all of it. And we took him home, and when he walked into the bunkhouse, he looked around with these deep blue, burning red eyes, and he looked at every single one of the people there, Mike Dino and guys from Alabama, and he saw Cherry. I don't know why he fixed on Cherry. I think he probably hated folks to be sucking on their toes. Because he pulled a knife out and leaped across the room toward Cherry, who drew himself up like this, just whoo, like that. And it was a good thing he pulled his feet out of the way, because that's what Tex was going after, his toes. He's going to cut his toes off. Tex came down with that knife at the end of the bunk bed. Boom! Now, the bunk beds are a little flat mattress on wood, all right? There's not even a spring. That knife went boom into the wood. And I was the only one who knew how light Tex was. Everyone just stood back. And I went up behind Tex, and I took the knife like this and went like that until it snapped off. And when the knife snapped off, it was as though Tex's back snapped. You might understand that better than me. I gave up on existentialism. But I didn't. You know how I did? Because when I looked at Tex, I said, I am better than him. I said, I am a reader. I am smart. I am a writer. I am educated. I will not make those mistakes. I think I began to think I might be a Stoic from that point on. That I would live in moderation, that I would plan my life. This is serious. That I would no longer allow that kind of slobberiness. I began to see this goodness in morality, at least, that morality protected me from that kind of crappy existence. And I would not allow that to happen to me. In fact, I remember within the week following, once on an evening, I tell you, I hated the work on the PPAC. I did not like to be a migrant worker. This was no wonderful vision for me. I was not getting down with the people and all that kind of stuff. I was making money, okay? But I do remember one evening, after one of those long, long days, you strip, you work with shorts, unless you're in the field, then you better have jeans on. But if you're at the machines, you can have shorts, shoes, and that's it. And you sweat all day long. It just pours off of you. But when the sun goes down to the horizon, people, there is a moment of blessing. And the wind blows, and it's cool. And you stand there, and you just put your rake down. I understand this. And you feel that breeze go around your whole body, as though it feathers the entire body. And the sweat now is dried in the breeze, and it is cool. And the sun has made the whole sky orange. And in a minute, it'll be azure, and then it'll be amethyst. You know that. The Illinois sky is your amethyst. And in that minute, I remember leaning on that rake, and I was existentialist. I said, Satis est. I said, Es ist genug. I thought, this is enough. This is enough. This is good. Now, that's the attitude I took with me to graduate school. When I went to graduate school, I didn't tell people this because I was embarrassed to. I really played it both ways. I must tell you. I was in the church, I was shy, I was a good person, I was not a bad person with all this, but these are the things I was depending on. And I said in my soul, I'm going to become a poet. I said that. I'm going to become the greatest, I mean, I didn't stop at poet, all right? I'm going to become the greatest poet of my age. I said that. And then I went to graduate school. All my class went on to Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, 801 D-Mile. I went to Miami of Ohio, studying literature to teach it. I was going to get a master's degree in a year and a bit. I was going to get all the work done by middle spring, and then I was going to get my thesis done by early summer. I was not Tex. I would never be Tex. I would plan my life. I did. When I got to graduate school, I lived in a small apartment. There was just a tiny little kitchen that I could barely sit down in, a little bathroom, and a room. And in that room, I slept for a long time on a cot. And I began to take classes. And I was building me. I was building Walt. I had been triumphant for 6 years. I had acted. I had made people like me. I had made people cry over me. I remember once the vision as I was in the back of the bus pulling away from Arcadia. Barbara Witzke was standing behind that bus. This is where I had a lifeguard for a summer. And the most extraordinary thing happened as I looked out the back window. Barbara and I had kind of gone together for that summer. Barbara cried. But her face, it was like glass. It just shattered. I had never seen that before. It was like someone cracked her face like glass and just shattered. And that shattering, I couldn't get out the window. This is the last time I ever saw her. But that went right into me. And I think I was not a good person. I mean, everyone thought I was. And I think I liked Barbara. But I think I took those tears and that shattered face as a triumph. I am. I can. I will. I do. Ahoy. Ahoy me. I think this is not another combat. What is the pattern of salvation? What does God do? On the one hand, I'd like to say God does nothing. You see, what has happened here is the human being has allowed the self to become God, as I write here. If I worship the self, and then the next thought is I am enslaved by it, but I think we are at that point worshiping the self. I think God does nothing, on the one hand. It's as though God says, this is your choice, Walt. Let's see where it takes you. It's as though in the parable of the father and the two sons, the father would say in his heart to the younger son, this is your choice to take all that I have given you and to leave me? To go into a far country separated from me? You may take that choice. Let's see what it does for you. Now you begin to notice something as soon as I put it in that context. It is not the gift, people, listen to me. It is not the gift which is infinite. It is the giver which is infinite. It is only the giver, not the gift, which is infinite. And if the Son should take the gift and leave the giver, no matter how beautiful, good, or blessed that gift is, it is finite. It runs out. I think maybe God does nothing. Except, now this is important, except that God is. Just is. And at that point, is. Not even particularly human or anthropomorphic, neither male nor female, but is infinite. Is almighty. Allmächtiger. Omnipotent. Is all. And here's what I think happens. I think as slowly we become aware that the God which is, and is infinite against our finitude, I think the very infinity of God, in contrast, reveals the finity which we are. And we were saying, I am. Don't you understand that to believe that we are infinite or that our existence depends totally upon ourselves is as foul and bitter a lie as the one that the serpent told Eve? That you will not die, but that you may be like God. Our finitude always comes flat up against the fact of our death. But it isn't death at the end of life, despite whatever the existentialists say. It is the death that we persistently live within in life. It is the constant finitude. There is a vast difference. This is what causes grief in people, between the fact that I may dream infinitely, but I can perform only finitely. This is the grief that people hit when they pass from adolescence into adulthood. They could do anything, they said. No, that's not exactly the truth. They could think they could do everything. They could imagine they could do everything. They could dream they could do everything. But when the time came for them to do it, they could only just do. And the contrast between the infinity of the dream, or put it another way, the contrast between the deity, which can both dream and do everything, And me, who can dream everything but do only some things, is outrageously wretched. It makes me angry. It makes me angry at that deity. Oh, there is no love at this point. God just is. And the very being of God, over against the being of separated, individual, foolish and stupid people, reveals separation, foolishness, stupidities. Do you begin to understand what I'm saying? I think God does nothing, but I don't think he ever ceases loving. I think standing on the roof, that father watched that second son go away and knew exactly what was going to happen. And waited. And waited. That's the beauty of the dear God, that the God persistently waits. And blessed are they who wait upon the Lord, but there's a beautiful passage in Isaiah that says that God waits to be merciful. I think that's what it is, waiting. The mercy, we don't even know. The mercy isn't even there. If I worship the self, then I am enslaved by it, whether I know it or not. And here comes the dread. For me to be set free from that taskmaster means that the taskmaster must die. And here is the irony. The taskmaster is me. I must die. Something in me must die. I must be without hope. And that is despair. A Jew in a pig pen? Did you ever think about that? That the second son, the prodigal son, went up against the world, discovered finitude, and the last thing ended in a pig pen and wished to eat the pods that pigs ate? Swine? It's against the law to eat pigs, to care for pigs. That's not just a stinky thing. That's a religious outrage. A Jew in a pig pen? Worst place to be. And what was it that that Jew said? When he came to his senses or himself, when he woke up, he said, and I'm going to only take half the sentence, and I know I'm filling with the text, but he said, I am, and then he didn't quit there. He said, unworthy. That's dying. And in this life, that's terrible. It hurts. It hurts, but it is so necessary against the blasphemous attitude. To be free, the self must die. This pattern recurs again and again through Scripture. You come in the presence of the deity, and what is the first thing? Oh, God, I love you so much. I'm glad you're here. Buddy, buddy, Jesus. No, you come into the presence of the deity, and the first thing Isaiah says is, God, I'm going to die. Because in the presence of righteousness, the only thing I can be aware of is unrighteousness. Because I am a person of unclean lips, and I come from a whole people of unclean lips. Listen, 3 days ago when I told you, or 2 days ago, whatever it was, when I told you that I had discovered forgiveness of sins when my dad hugged me instead of spanking me, what I did not understand at that point is the absolute necessity of the forgiveness of sin, not sins. Sin. Forgiveness of me for what I am, not for all the little things that I have done. That's the depth of this dying, which must take place. That's how deep it goes. That's why Isaiah cries out, I have said some bad words. No, it says, I am of unclean lips, and the whole people is. When Peter, in the boat, suddenly recognizes Jesus' deity because Jesus had told him to cast the net over the wrong side of the boat at the wrong hour of the day, and he got a whole shoal of fishes, what does Peter do? Falls down on his knees in a boat. He doesn't wait for the shore. And he says, get away from me! Because why? Because I am a sinful man. In the presence of the deity, I collapse. That's the first thing God is. A terrible, terrible being in contrast. What is it that happens to St. Paul, all full of zealousness? St. Paul, all full of himself, on the way to Damascus. The Lord speaks and the guy goes blind. Boom! 3 days blind. Nothing. Must be led around. A nothing. A nobody. And I don't have the time, I see. But I would read to you. I suggest that you read St. John of the Cross and the Dark Night of the Soul, to understand something of this total loss, this absolute loss, this death. I went to graduate school, proud of myself, shy, silent, retiring, but deeply inside. I'm the more villainous of proud people, don't you know? Because my pride is secret. People couldn't see it. I didn't look arrogant. I did not lift my nose. I was proud internally. I was proud. I was going to stay with the church. There was no Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in Oxford. It was ALC. But I was going to do right. So I went looking for a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod church, which was in Richmond, Indiana, about 40 minutes drive. And I drove to that church. And I was very proud of the fact that I was doing the right thing. not aware of all the stuff that I have told you, that was really my faith. When I got there, now I want to tell you an axiom, which you know and you must ever remember. Pride cannot abide pride. One's pride cannot abide another's pride. Two prideful people cannot live side by side. When I got to church, I happened to sit in front of a man who sang tenor, loud and clear on every hymn, and it nearly withered me. I thought, what a proud butt. And it irritated me. It irritated my worship. I couldn't worship with this guy showing his voice off to the whole world, this proud, bright tenor. Of course, not remembering what some guy had told me way back in Milwaukee about singing bass. But I came back a second time. I was going to do it, and lo and behold, guy sat behind me a second time. He sang his tenor so loud, it rang in my ears. My hair came forward. I said, this is church. I said, this is church. I'm not going to have any parts in it. Besides which, the pastor took me to his home and showed me all of his electronic equipment. Now, I tell you, I was not a good person. I was a proud person. And I thought, as I looked at this pastor's electronic, I said, how could you be a pastor? You haven't the same commitment to the deeper questions that I have. Fooling around with electronic equipment. He had a ham radio. He had built his own stuff like that. His sermons were relatively thin and puling. I could have done better than that. I am. And so I ceased to go to church upon those reasons. Now, when the crust broke and the cocoon came off the worm began to show its own shape. And the worm had nothing to touch around him. And then began for me my dark night. I don't know that I can make you feel it the way I did, but it was terrible. I could quote, you know, sweetly with self-pity stuff like Dover Beach, but I remember, I'll tell you what began. It began in me like a tiny little worm. I would say it began like a worm wriggling, like a little spasm. And it was loneliness. I was lonely. And I thought I was just lonely because there were not people around that were my friends and my classmates. I thought that's what it was. I was wrong, but because I thought that, I could stand it at the beginning of this process of my master's degree. Except the strange thing happened. When we came, I took Shakespearean tragedies for the first course, and I was reading Macbeth in my room one night, and I came upon this very familiar passage, and I couldn't stand it. All of a sudden, this is no longer sweet stuff to talk about the empty and meaningless world. My emotions began to get involved, and it got to be killing stuff. When Lady Macbeth dies, this is Macbeth's response. It is familiar, she says. He says, she should have died hereafter. There would have been time for such a word. And then he says, tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. Tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow. This is Camus. But now it wasn't sweet to me. Now this began to shake me very much, and I want to give another word for lonely. It frightened me. Listen. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Ow, grief, candle. It's all Macbeth's wife's life was. Life's but a walking, listen to this. Life's but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, but signifying nothing. Now that was Camus. But when I came upon it in here, in Shakespeare's words, that terrified me. And I began to feel as though I was walking with my shoulders up all the time, going to class. The loneliness began to grow in me. I still did all right. During the first term, I got A's and everything. But I noticed that I was really tense all the time and that I was beginning to react to things which looked lonely as though they were me. Forgive me for this. I don't know if it'll make sense. But outside of my room, there was a sycamore tree that had been twisted off, a huge trunk that had literally been twisted off so that it left a great twist of fiber and bark up like that. And every time I looked at that tree, I felt like crying. I thought, what a goddamn agony. This is. To me, it became like a symbol of some human being's twisted gut that was left in the twist with no meaning nor any reality behind it. And I had trouble looking at that. I said to myself in those days, because I had left church, my mind started working on theology, and I was beginning to hate God. I mean that. At this point came the distinction between the finite and the infinite. I said, all God is. All God is. And I said, it's as though God is sleeping in a bed. Indifferent. And what God does is toss an arm out like this, bam, and knocks the wall over. And doesn't care. And doesn't, I really did not like God then. I never doubted the existence of God. I said to myself, by the way, yes, I sinned, because I knew I had guilt. But I also said to myself that if I had guts enough, I would go to the people that I had sinned against. I didn't know anything about sinning against God, to be frank with you and honest. I'd never met God at this point in my life. I mean, despite all the previous stories. So I figured if I had the guts, I would go to the people I had sinned against and ask their forgiveness. But there still was this lurking sense of loneliness that I could not name, and it was growing in me, people. It was no longer a worm, it was a serpent, and it was growing throughout my tummy. And I must tell you something, that this sense of loneliness made me, A, more desperate to achieve I am, and more fearful that I would not, could not achieve. Do you understand what I'm saying? So that every test that came before me now was a moral proposition. It wasn't just a graduate school issue, it was an issue. This is what happens, don't you understand, when you have begun to create yourself. Everything you do takes on infinite meaning. Too much. If I would fail at a test, I didn't just fail at a test. Wally failed. I failed. This person did. And this thing that I was building in front of me was suddenly with a broken arm or a twisted mind. I am. And I went shuddering to my tests. I wanted to tell people about my loneliness. That's the only word. Do you know what it was? It was a loneliness without end. Every other loneliness I had in my life, I could always look to an end for it. In summer, I would say, well, wait till we get back to school again. At school, I could say, wait till I go visit home, and my loneliness will be over. But see, I had entered my life, people. There's none of this children stuff anymore, back and forth. This was it. And it was lonely. And it grew. Until I found that I would just lie on the floor listening to music. I tried to tell people about this thing, and when I sat down and I said such things as, I'm lonely, they said, so what? So is everybody. But I couldn't put, the problem was that this was an experience like I'd never had before. I could not name it. I could not communicate it. It was de spero. It was de spero, which means to be without. I was up against an infinite God. And when I closed my heart, when I closed my ears, deep down inside of me, I heard running over and over again a prayer. The shortest little baby prayer I ever prayed in my life. But it was going all the time, always. I didn't try to do it. It was like rumbling. It was like music in the back inside of me. And it was, love me, love me, love me, love me, love me, love me, love me. That was my prayer, always. And it was partly to God, but it was partly to anybody I could look at. On Thanksgiving, or later, I got into my Volkswagen with the roof down or up, whatever. And I drove all the way from Ohio through Indiana through Illinois to get to St. Louis to see my classmates. I thought, they will help me. And one of them was breaking up with a girl at that point, and another one was busy with his work and wouldn't talk to me. And I went into chapel. I truly, people, you know, finally here I am before God. Love me. I went into chapel at Concordia Seminary, 801 Des Moines, and they preached about some guy who had died 100 years before on that day, whose name I never heard and never heard again. And when I drove home from that place, it snowed. And I began to see what condition I was in, because it snowed great fat flakes. And you know how close your nose is to a Volkswagen window? But to me, every one of those flakes was living and hated me and was attacking. They came, whoa, 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 at the window. And it was like I flinched from every one of those things. Well, don't you understand, people, that when you are finite, when you begin to take the measure of yourself and it is so small, all the world indifferent is an enemy. Even the snow. There came a time in the spring, I got to the point where I had not the energy to handle little bumps in my head. I would go into my little kitchen and I would try to do the dishes, and I would come up against one of the doors of the cupboard and bump myself like that. And I had to quit everything. That would almost discombobulate me. I remember that I finally got into a car. I wanted to visit my friend. This is in the spring. I had four papers to write in 2 weeks. And I had my oral examinations for my master's degree. I was never going to be like X. And I couldn't do those things. They were too important. I couldn't do them. I was creating me with them, and I was failing. Do you understand? I could not do them. I got into a car and drove all the way up to Fort Wayne to visit my friends, and I thought, I will get something from them, some Sympathos, some comfort. Some loved me, loved me, loved me. And I mean, this is a couple with children. I was just going to stay at their house one night, and they were fighting. The couple was fighting. Where was God? What was God doing? God was letting them fight. They wouldn't even listen to me. They didn't see how wan and pale I was. I mean, I was the romantic poet. I could throw myself on the floor. I got into the car, and I drove all the way back that night. That was a Sunday night. And I finally planned what I was going to do. I said, I'm going to go to the dean of the graduate school, and I'm going to ask him, please, could I have an extension on these four papers? That was all my classes, and on these oral exams, and could I still keep my National Defense Fellowship? You see, that was the National Defense Fellowship. It was the United States of America saying unto Walt Longren, yes, you do have good brain. I needed to keep that. So the next morning, I hadn't slept all night. I went into Spiro Peterson's office. He was a short little fellow. He was a kind man. And I sat down across from him. I can see what eyes I had. I must have had blue with red. All around the blue, fire red. And I said to him, Dr. Peterson, could I please get an extension on these things, and could we skip my oral examinations till the end of the summer and still keep my fellowship? He said to me, why? And I said, without even planning it, I said, because I'm having trouble with God. And he said, I'm sorry, no. And I know he was a kind man, because when he said no, I burst into tears at the age of 22 and sobbed. And he got up and closed the door so that I could cry. Now, this was the end, people. I died. There was nowhere to go. There was nothing to do. All my plans had been run out. I could not create Walt anymore. And I got up from his office, and I walked out of Little Oxford, and I walked along a road. It was spring, it was nice. I didn't know where I was going. I had nowhere to go. I was dead. Something in me was dead. I saw sheep over on the side. There were sheep over there. And I hated those sheep. Those way face sheep. I hated them because I could run at them. I could run and go booga 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 like that. And they'd all scatter. Like that. Because I was bigger than them. You know why I hated them? They were me. That's what I was in this world. Sheep. With sawed off teeth and no horns and no way to run and no way to fight and no way to be independent, no way to protect oneself. I stood staring at them. Stay with me a minute. I stared at those sheep, and while I did, there came out from behind the woods, behind them, a veil of trees, there came a fat old farmer with a bib overalls on. Now those sheep were staring at me. It was like they're all set for me to attack. He came wobbling over, and he went, made a clucking sound in his, and all those sheep instantly stopped looking at me. And turned around and followed him peacefully through the tree. And Pastor Shep said in my ear 15 years before, I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me. And I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will be one shepherd. I promise you, people, I remember those words then. And I said that I wanted to be nothing more nor less. I wanted to be sheep. I wanted Jesus to go. And I was just behind him. No, I wasn't going to leave me anymore. I wasn't going to. And that's exactly what I said. I said with words or without, I don't remember. I said, Lord, it's yours. I mean, there was nothing. There was nothing. You do. You do. You do. And whatever is that you do is fine. Whether I'm smart, stupid, that doesn't make any. Whether I graduate or don't, that doesn't make. And I went back. Now, I cut it short here. At the best part, I cut it short. To tell you that when I didn't have to write those papers, you understand that? When nomos was no longer there, when the law was no longer there, when I didn't have to write those papers, I did. I could. When I didn't have to take those oral examinations, I did. I could. When I had finally shut all that was me and allowed that to be. But do you understand the only way I could have done that was to die to it, to find its failure and its dustiness. I could only in death cling to Christ. Then this God which was took on the merciful face of Jesus Christ. I know this sounds cheesy, people, but I got four A's. And I finished those oral examinations in a whiz. But I really think, finally, the major thing is that it was the Lord who was alive always, and it was finally Walt Longren who had to go through this process of dying. Oh, there's so much more to tell. But they rang the bell. Think it through yourself. Amen.